Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is Elizabeth Oldfield. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you today?
I'm doing really well, thanks. It's lovely to be here.
Fantastic. For those who haven't come across you before, how would you sum up yourself? What's your elevator pitch?
Oh, I don't have one. And that question always gives me an existential crisis. What to say? I am speaking to you from a small intentional community in South London, where I live with my delightful and beloved family and another family. For my day job, I host a podcast called Sacred. I write a Substack and have a book called Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. And I'm interested in how do we translate the treasures of the Christian tradition for people who might have some quite good reasons for thinking that's not for me.
Brilliant. Well, we're really excited to have you on and recommend the Sacred and the Substack as well. Both really interesting conversations, particularly in the Sacred, with bringing in lots of voices from across culture. Why don't we begin with Fully Alive then, as that's a kind of a big project for you over the last few years. Do you want to explain a little bit more about what the argument the book is trying to make, and also in particular how you went about pitching what is a kind of, is it a Christian book, is it not, to a relatively secular publisher?
Yeah. So I would say getting on for 10 years now, I've been feeling this sense of an uptick in spiritual openness in wider culture. And my husband's a philosopher, and between the two of us, we engage and encounter with a lot of people who I would call kind of open-minded, thoughtful questioners. They wouldn't have called themselves seekers, but people interested in what a good life is and what a human being is, who had been really shaped by new atheism and were then finding themselves sort of perhaps slightly reluctantly thinking maybe they'd written off this whole religion thing too early. And so I found myself both in our community house and through my work at Theos and on the podcast and just around about having these questions about the sort of goodness and truth and beauty that I find in the Christian tradition and that I think is incredibly relevant and helpful for everyone, and that it can be something... The phrase I always come back to, Alan de Botton says, the problem with Christians is they want you to eat everything on the plate. And I do think there is a sense in which people who are not Christians or have not encountered the church do think that the only way in is like, that like the door is baptism, right? That you can't go anywhere near it unless you're prepared to just like sign up to the whole thing. And we can sometimes give that impression, right? And what I have felt more fruitful actually in conversation is just say, oh, there's this interesting way of thinking about what the human being is in Christianity that find helpful. And they'd be like, oh yeah, that's actually quite interesting. And I'll maybe talk about, a relational understanding of sin, or my sense that the Christian sexual ethic is actually quite feminist, and have these conversations and find it really easy actually to cross what people might have expected to be quite deep divides. And so Fully Alive is a collection of personal essays loosely structured around the seven deadly sins, that the hope is that it says there's wisdom here. Like you might, there's a bit in the bookshop that's religion and Christianity where, you know, everything is exiled there and no one goes near it unless they know that's what they're looking for. Everyone else just scans the like wisdom, spirituality, you know, ancient
self-help.
Wisdom, self-help, exactly. In which there's a load of rubbish and a load of good, sane, thoughtful insight into the human. It's like, why can't some Christian ideas be in that section? Why can't we get them there as a way of people encountering them maybe for the first time and finding them helpful? So that's what Fully Alive's all about.
And how did publishers respond to the pitch?
So I have an amazing agent who is like vehemently non-religious and sort of still surprises me that she took me on. This is not her bread and butter. This is not her world. She just likes my voice, which is one of the most beautiful things for a writer to hear. And so I think it was very transformative because she worked with me for a long time on the proposal. And I ended up basically writing to her. Like, if I can write about the Christian sexual ethic, or I can write about avarice, or I can write about why on earth you might go to church for Sophie, who has no track with any of this nonsense, then I might be able to write about it for a wider audience. So that, I think, was very transformative. I'm very grateful to her. As it happened, we had three or four like big mainstream publishers, super interested. One of them bought Lamorna Ash's book that's just come out, Don't Forget We're Here Forever Instead, and was like, I'm really sorry, we can't have two God books at the same time.
Heaven forbid.
And we ended up going with the bit of Hodder that's a bit more faith influenced. So at the time I was like, oh, I really wanted it to be with a fully mainstream publisher, and instead it's with a mainstream publisher with a faith bit. But actually the wider bit of Hodder got really interested in it and were very helpful in the end, and it ended up being something that crossed some of those divides. So I think we just about managed to get it out of the quarantine enclosure that Christian books get put in, yeah, and out into the bloodstream, yeah, of the wider conversation.
The cynic in me often says that the things that Christians produce that are intended for non-Christian readers or consumers or watchers, yeah, are often most adored and loved by fellow churchgoers.
Oh yeah.
And then we end up kind of talking to ourselves, even if we pretend that this is all kind of outward focused.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense what has the reaction been? Obviously, you know, I've read reviews in the Church Times and all the other places, yeah, yeah, but yeah, do you have any sense about how much it has percolated beyond the walls of the church and into the bloodstream?
Yeah, a bit. It felt like a complete kamikaze project. I was like, I'm going to write a book that Christians won't like because it's too sweary and honest and frank about sex. And it's just, in order to write it, I had to stop being careful. You know, like most of the Christian content is produced by either pastors or theologians, which is great, but their training is like avoid error at all costs. Hmm. And also don't really show your, you know, don't make it super personal. Don't make it about you. And that's good. You don't want pastors who are making it all about you. But the kind of writing that I had a hunch would actually connect needed to not be that. Needed to not be careful. Needed not to be terrified of making mistakes. Needed to be very human and very honest. And so I was like, oh, Christians aren't going to read this because they either know it or they're going to think I'm a heretic, frankly. And no one else will go near it because it's too Christian or too religious. And neither of those things have proved to be the case. Christians seem to have been encouraged by it. Like they seem to have felt like it helped them see their faith afresh, to have it described as it might be for someone who's never encountered it, particularly American Christians, which I'm astonished by. I really thought American Christians would, yeah, like me.
Did you think you'd never be invited back again, basically? You were outing yourself as a dangerous liberal.
I did. I mean, the funny thing is I'm not, but I'm really like being someone who's really listened to people outside the church and is not instinctively hostile towards them. In fact, has quite a lot of love for them, as I think God has, can set off people's defense mechanisms. But anyway, it was just me being judgy and prejudiced because actually I keep getting asked to go speak in America. There's lots, it's selling really well there. Non-Christians, not so far in the US that much, although lovely Oliver Berkman recommended it on the Ezra Klein Show, which is a huge New York Times podcast. And since then, mainstream bookshops are beginning to stock it. So hopefully that will get out. And in the UK, it got some really good mainstream media coverage. I was on BBC One, I was on Radio 4, I was in the Times. I was on the Goop podcast. You two won't know what that is because you're men. But
Gwyneth.
It is Gwyneth Paltrow's wellness podcast.
Wow.
it has broken down the walls a bit. And I think the thing that I was expecting to happen, if anything happened at all, is that Christians are buying it for their friends and their friends are liking it and then sometimes giving it to their other friends. So that's
amazing. I mean, you must feel it's a pretty miserable task being a writer, don't you think? I mean, I think you stare at a screen for hours on end and rework stuff, and you have acute periods of self-doubt and, why am I doing this? Is anybody got it? Well, at least that's what happens with me. I don't know. Did it happen to you?
I don't have that.
Really?
No. I think I put off being a writer for so long because I was too scared and I thought my voice wasn't legitimate and I wasn't an Oxbridge Debating Society male, and therefore why would anyone listen to me? That when I came to it, I had really high levels of sort of effort energy. I was like, woo, let's see what happens. And I'm just going to write the thing I think God's put on my heart to write. And then it's not my business if anyone reads it or not. And so it was really liberating. That's what I mean. Like, I deliberately had almost no expectations about it. And so anyone reading it feels like a joy.
No, oh, that's great. I mean, wonderful. And have you got more in the works? Have you got the...
The important follow-up. Your sophomore effort.
It's the second novel, isn't it? The second novel.
Well, that's the thing. I'm trying not to buy into any of that. I'm like, this is not a career decision. I don't have a strategy. Like, God said, this is the book you need to write. So I've written this book. Now I think I might be writing a novel. It's not very good.
Ooh.
Who knows?
Exciting.
But no, I don't yet have enough to say. That's like 15 years of reflection in that one book.
I find it really interesting because we mentioned this off mic. We had Graham Tomlin on the podcast not too long ago. And in some ways, what he's doing with Seen and Unseen and the Center for Cultural Witness and that kind of stuff is a slightly analogous task to what you set yourself in trying to be a bridge between the church, which has often kind of hoarded its gold and its treasure, and trying to say to an increasingly curious society that might be worth giving a second look. Maybe this 2,000-year-old tradition has something to say about Grenfell Tower or immigration or Donald Trump or whatever the issue might be. I'd love to know a little bit more about why you think culture is more open to this. What are the signs that you're picking up about kind of increased curiosity to what Christianity has to say?
Yes. So I think we probably reached the like bottom of at least this wave of secularization not that long after the new atheism began to really pull. There was a sense in which for a while the idea that it was possible to live like really meaningful ethical lives with no religion and find them satisfying and be able to hold together a society looked like it might, you know, might work. And then as that, both that movement splintered and most of the people trying to follow it found themselves just deeply dissatisfied, that question of, okay, so what if this, you know, what if this instinct in us to worship is not like an evolutionary dead end that we need to figure our way out of? What if it is something deep within us for a reason? And so I think that's part of it, what John Vervaeke calls the meaning crisis. Like we're not, it's actually not really that easy to, postmodernism might have had skepticism of meta-narratives, but as it turns out, we are, you know, Charles Taylor says we are storied selves. We are story-shaped creatures. Our own tiny story is actually not enough for us to orient ourselves within. We want to be in part of bigger stories. So the meaning crisis stuff, I think, for a lot of young people, the climate crisis is enormous. We have a very strong sense that the world as we have known it is going to break down through our own fault. And the world that we've left for younger people is in a mess. So why would the like smug, everything's going to get better if we're all just smart enough story appeal to them? They need wisdom and they're willing to look anywhere, frankly. And then I think the sense of that spiritual yearning that's always deep within us just started being given a bit more permission to emerge. And I think Jordan Peterson is a big part of this for men. Like I have some complex reactions to him. But he said a lot of things and some of it has been giving people permission to admit metaphysical yearnings and go look at the Bible. And then psychedelics and the rise of kind of spirituality and wellness, actually, much as there are areas of that I think are deeply unhealthy, again, opened up space for people to reflect, to ask themselves what they think meaning is, what kind of life they want to live. And I'm sort of the opinion that the spirit will use whatever space we open up, whatever, any moments where we're undefended and undistracted and seeking meaning and seeking something bigger than ourselves are places that the love of God can use to draw us to himself.
Yeah, I think all those things I resonate with. I think it is striking, isn't it, how people like Tom Holland and others have particularly finding this historical perspective on the roots of Western civilization have given, a new sense of intellectual heft and roots and pervasiveness of Christian thinking, which had got lost somewhere.
I mean, I always feel Nick Spencer is not a high ego man and would never say this himself, but I always feel a little bit sad for Nick Spencer because this is what he was saying for about 10 years before Dominion came out. Like, we are soaring off the branch on what we are, on which we are sitting, right? Like, could you look at the ground beneath our feet? And that sense of just a slightly more realistic understanding of who we are and where these ideas come from, and that dawning sense for most people that they actually are not, that despite, you know, the claims of a birthing nation, they are not self-evident. that the idea that all humans are equal is not self-evident. It, in some ways, is the opposite is evident. Absolutely right. Most societies that have
most
not
unlikely,
held...
isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really unlikely. It is a faith position, essentially, and so important for how we like to think of ourselves and how we want to live and the kind of nations that we want to build. And yes, this sense of like, this might not be for stupid people. This might be a sense of idea, a set of ideas that have some heft and some richness to them. That's really shifted even in the last decade.
I think it's that I really resonate with that. I remember, you know, I was a little bit younger than both of you, and I was a kind of teenager in the heyday of new atheism in the 2000s. But even then, I could see that it was kind of, you know, if someone kind of came out as a Christian in public life, there was a danger of derision, of ridicule. It was a kind of, you know, it was your superstition from your Stone Age. You know, it was people who needed to...
Flying spaghetti monster,
all that stuff. It was laughable. And whereas I think today, if a public intellectual comes out as an Orthodox believer, they don't get derided or treated with contempt. That the ideas have become kind of palatable, even if you don't necessarily agree with them. Mm-hmm. You know, in the kind of public intellectual space, people now say, yeah, well, I mean, you know, Christianity is an interesting, you know, worldview, an interesting set of values. Let's debate it. What I'm less convinced of is how much that has filtered from that kind of elite intellectual Tom Holland space down to your ordinary British, American, kind of Western secularist, people who don't read Dominion, who don't follow the podcasts. How much are they any more open to faith than they might have been 20 or 30 years ago?
So I have, like, my impression of it is incredibly bad statistics, because we live in an intentional community designed exactly for people with metaphysical yearnings to come and talk to us if they want to. So we're seeing a lot of them, a lot of ordinary people who would have been secular. But even I think, like, in our wider community, like the parents at my kids' school, not all of them, because it's a very mixed neighborhood, but the kind of, like, frankly, like, mainly white people who have two degrees and work in professional jobs. Even like when my kids started school, I'd be like, the temptation to be like, we're Christians, but not those kind of Christians, you know, like, to talk about our faith with quite a lot of caveats and preparation has gone. And I think there is just, honestly, it's like a deep misery. There's a real sense of, what have we done? How are we living? Like, I'm aware that I'm trying to buy myself out of despair. These guys say that there might be another way. Maybe it's worth giving them a listen.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because that is an astonishing reversal over, isn't it, in just the cultural zeitgeist over less than 20 years. And of course, it could equally go the other way.
Yeah,
I think that's what, you know, you see these, there are fluctuations. But nonetheless, what an extraordinary opportunity, I think. And yet, there are also concerns, aren't there? I mean, and I heard you speak to a very secular audience a few months ago, and you were talking about both the quest for enchantment and for wonder was a very positive thing, that people were looking for meaning, looking for the supernatural and so on. But you also made the point that potentially there was a very dark side to that, that not all wonder was necessarily a very light-filled and positive element.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of what I mean by the spiritual openness means you can be open to anything, right? It's the sort of GK Chesterton thing of, like, the point is to close it on something that's actually going to nourish you. I both see just like that. So one of the key elements, I think, certainly amongst younger people, and I think a lot of people of your generation, John, would be surprised at how widespread this is the taking of psychedelics. And so, the number of people that come on my podcast and just casually, either on the podcast or afterwards, are like, well, of course, I did do those ayahuasca ceremonies, and really stuff changed for me when I started using psilocybin. regularly. And so it has become like, for people who are looking for healing, healing journeys are a big thing, healing, wanting to do inner work, people who are looking for meaning and belonging and transcendence, and frankly, like to find some steadiness for their souls, now taking quite powerful psychotropic drugs are one of the reasonably mainstream options. Like, you could do some yoga, you could go on a silent retreat, you could take some mushrooms. And I both have seen that mean that people stop being atheists and start asking questions about Jesus, and I have seen it mean people lose their minds and cause themselves harm, right? Mm. Like, I have a friend called Jules Evans who writes a Substack called Psychedelic Integration, and he is not hostile to psychedelics totally, says they've very well evidenced in clinical settings, as you would know much better than me, John, and there are some responsible uses of them for personal growth, but there are also a lot of these people who have lasting difficulties from using them, and the industry does not want to talk about that because so much money is going into it right now. So there's that kind of just like harm. And one question I have about that is, how much of that harm is spiritual? Because someone like Ashley Land, who's written a book about this, would say it's not unusual to meet demons on a mushroom trip, right? It's also not unusual to meet Jesus. Like, what are they doing? I'm fascinated by this. Tell me who to talk to, John. It's like, what is it, like thinning the veil? Like, yeah, what is happening?
Well, I'm fascinated in this. And I think, again, it's a feature of the Enlightenment, is this dualism between the physical and the spiritual.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of post-Enlightenment Christians have effectively bought into this dualism. Mm. Well, certainly within the sort of, particularly the kind of non-charismatic and conservative evangelical world, where the safest thing is to believe there's either this kind of physical world, you know, or else there's God in his spiritual world. But by and large, apart from occasional events, there's no real connection.
Jesus.
Whereas the New Testament, I mean, I'm just struck by how the New Testament is this, quote, porous universe.
Yeah.
Where constantly good and evil is the stage in which things are happening. And it's particularly striking in the run-up to the Passion narratives, where it says that, you know, Judas Iscariot clearly has got, you know, is doing a bit of sharp business with the post and, you know, with the money, and is going to betray Jesus. But then the text says that the devil enters into Judas Iscariot. And Jesus says to Pilate, this is your hour and your authority, the hour of your authority. I think what we're rediscovering is that porous universe, that sense that actually both demons and positive spiritual things, angels, are much closer, are much more active than you might think.
So we were reading Acts 11 in our community house on Friday mornings. We get up and we read several chapters of the Bible together aloud. And in Acts 11, it's the bit where an angel frees Peter, and that in and of itself, like, the angel freed him. That's a thing. And then Peter gets back to the house, and this young girl opens the door and basically screams and then slams the door in his face, goes back and tells everyone, Peter's here. And they're like, no, he's not. And Peter's just patiently knocking on the door outside. But inside, the line they use is, you're out of your mind. It can't be him. It must be his angel.
Yeah.
What does that even mean? Like, there's all these pagan ideas about being able to, like, send yourself, like, a sort of
astral projection.
Exactly. A demon of yourself that other people can see in different places. I'm like, presumably that's not what they mean, but I don't know what they mean, and there's no footnote, and it feels like no one knows what they mean. Like, there is all this world in which the scriptures are enchanted in a way that we are not. And it's one of the things that I find most comforting about believing in the power of the love of God is the dark bits. I'm like, I do believe in them. I need to be armed with the full armor of God, and then mainly they're not my business, right? I have to just turn my face towards the love of God and shelter under the shadow of his wings, because if I get too interested in the dark stuff, that's bad. And I see some of that happening, both amongst people outside the church, but also amongst Christians. There's a book by Rod Dreher called Reenchantment. And Rod Dreher, I find very confusing, because I really like deeply agree with about half of what he says. And I find about half of what he says a bit befuddling. And he's got very interested in the darkness and the demons in a way. Yes. I'm like, I don't necessarily intellectually disagree with you. I'm just not sure this is the posture. But maybe I'm just shaped by my Enlightenment heritage and a coward.
But I know what you mean, you know. I mean, it's one of those kind of truisms of being raised in evangelicalism is kind of being warned off, you know, here be dangers, you know, don't tread too deeply on that kind of both, you know, the end time stuff and the apocalyptic stuff about trying to disentangle Daniel and Revelation, but also about the demons. And that feels increasingly dissatisfying when you spend more time in the New Testament and you realize how often Jesus is having these extraordinary encounters with demonic spirits and sending them into pigs for reasons that remain slightly unclear to me. But also, you can see there are lots of examples of Christians who have gone off the deep end and who've got so fascinated with the kind of, I don't know what the language is, the kind of hyper-spiritual elements of it, that they lose sight of, as you say, what the primary focus of the text and the tradition is about, which is not about, you know, going into battle with demons. I don't think Jesus calls us to go and battle demons. So there's something about re-encountering the strangeness of the faith, but not letting it take over.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're all sort of feeling our way. I'm trying to write about this and finding it very difficult to find, you know, this right balance between, on the one hand, being written off as a complete nutter, but on the other hand, buying into this kind of enlightenment caution, you know, that we can't engage with the reality of this. One of the things that strikes me and that I've picked up from other people writing about this, and that is that the idea that wherever there is a concentration of power at a human level, we should expect the authorities and powers in heavenly places to be also engaged, and that their role is to sort of exacerbate and amplify human weakness. And it's very interesting to me. I've been reflecting on, you know, this well-known sort of power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Acton, apparently quite well-known historian of the Victorian era. But the question is, why? Why does power corrupt? And I think the answer is because of the authorities, because of these hidden spiritual forces. And so then you look on the planet today and you say, well, where is power concentrated today? And we would expect there to be some kind of evil spiritual force.
That's interesting. I think that absolute power corrupts absolutely because it's idolatry, and we start thinking we're God, and then our soul is poisoned. But I'm sure there's some people helping that along.
Yeah, but I suppose the question is, but why can't we use power for good? Why don't human beings learn how to use power for good? It's a hypothesis, but you know what you see across the world is you see people doing things utterly irrationally. I mean, if you think of Ukraine, you think of Gaza, you think of other places across the world where you think there are terrible evil things happening here, and yet from the outside there seems to be absolutely no possible reason. Is it possible that the reason why these things are happening is because of the influence of demonic forces?
I mean, sure. Seems possible. Maybe. It's hard. I don't know if I find that comforting or discomforting or helpful or not.
I mean, let me run past another idea of First Elizabeth, and that is that in conservative evangelical circles, our understanding of the cross has tended to be completely dominated by this understanding that Jesus died on the cross for our sins. I mean, to put it in theological language, it's the substitutionary atonement. And of course, I absolutely believe that that's right. But it's interesting to me that to the early Christian church, that was not the dominant understanding of the cross. The dominant understanding of the cross was that Jesus triumphed over evil powers. Mm. The cross was the mechanism by which evil powers became vanquished and overcome. And I just wonder whether we need to rediscover that understanding of the cross.
I spent some time with, that's such a weird phrase. Why do people who, particularly Christians who read books, say that? I was going to say, I spent some time with Fleming Rutledge in her book, The Crucifixion. We read Fleming Rutledge's book, The Crucifixion. And what I found so helpful about that book is the sense of like the kaleidoscopic meanings, the thing that it's not, and it was so liberatory for me because I was like, I don't know which theory of what happened on the cross is the correct one. I don't want to have to pick a team. It was important and I needed it and I'm glad of it. And I want to stand in the shadow of the cross. Like, I don't want to make it into a formula. And she really liberated me to go, what if it means all these things?
I remember church I was at many years ago did a whole sermon series on that whole idea that there are different lenses through which to look at the cross. And we did, you know, a week on penal substitutionary atonement and a week on Christus Victor and a week on Jesus.
Was this an Oxford church by any chance?
It wasn't. No. It was KXC in central London. HDB flavour, but with a really thoughtful vicar trying to help us see that you don't, as you say, you don't have to pick and choose. The mystery and the power and the majesty of the cross is that all of these things are happening at once. And that in this single moment in time, in history and place, these incredible cosmic eternal things are all folded into one, which is why it kind of melts our brains if you spend a little bit too much time trying to ponder it. One, you mentioned in passing a couple of times about your intentional community. A lot of people might not really know what exactly you're referring to there. Could you just give it a bit of a flavor and how does that play into these conversations about, you know, trying to use the richness of the Christian tradition to say something to a confused culture?
Yeah. I always feel like I'm possibly overstating it because in some ways it's very small and ordinary. We are just two families who've decided to covenant our lives together. We've decided to live a bit differently. So we are in a house together in South London and we have our own bedrooms, but we share all of the common space, and we have turned the garage into a chapel. We take turns cooking. We share most of our money and pay most things out of a common purse. And we have a monastic inspired rule of life, which just means a set of rhythms that we are committed to together that we hope are going to help us form us into the kind of people we want to be becoming. So it is not full monasticism. We all still have jobs, you know, that we have kids around, but it is a way of trying to, basically it's a way of trying to create some scaffolding or some trellis for our attention, because attention is so key to formation and discipleship and who we're becoming. And we're also finding it's very helpful for people who are bemused about Christianity. They find it very attractive to come into something where people are living a little bit differently. And it does feel like, in terms of trying to sort of hold out the treasure of our tradition to the world, it's easier if we don't look exactly like everyone else, right? It's easier if there is some level of distinctiveness, even with all our hypocrisy and fragility, being able to say we are at least trying to practice hospitality in a slightly more radical way. We are trying to practice generosity in a slightly more radical way. We're trying to practice interdependence in a slightly more radical way. I think the gospel is good news for many reasons. And one of them is that when we try and live in alignment with it, it's actually really good for us. It's how we flourish. And I think there's a sense of people instinctively can sense that and therefore want to move towards it.
And is it kind of, I mean, you mentioned this, the core of it is two families. Is it a kind of permeable community? Do you have people coming and living with you for a time? Mm-hmm. Can they come and eat with you and kind of share other elements of life?
Yeah. So we have big open table dinners every other Monday for 14 or 16 people. And a lot of the people who come through those dinners are then feel like they're part of a kind of dispersed community. And we have open house days when they're here, and people come stay short term. We had hoped to have a bigger property, but it's London. So we had two guest rooms, and then my kids eventually needed their own bedroom. So now we have one guest room, which is usually full. But we, you know, we have young children, and we don't have separable space from the wider house. And so we are quite aware of safeguarding concerns, and that different people have different callings, right? Some intentional communities are for people who are highly vulnerable or have addiction issues or struggling with mental health or are homeless. And the amazing beauty of that and the cost of that, if you don't set it up very well, can be very high. And our calling is slightly different. It's to be, yes, a place of hospitality, but for a small number of people to stay and a larger number of people to come through and be welcomed and be in conversation with.
It's a wonderful vision. And there is so much hunger, isn't there, for us at this kind of home context for hospitality. Mm. And we've tried to do something similar, but at a less, certainly much less structured way. And but we've just struck by the extraordinary hunger there is out there. I mean, it goes back to some of the things we've been talking about, isn't it? This sense of despair, loss of meaning, so many single households, so many broken relationships, broken marriages, broken families.
And modern society is almost uniquely atomizing. It forces people, particularly with the internet, you can kind of have this simulacrum of community, but you actually feel profoundly very alone. And, you know, with a housing crisis in many kind of large Western cities, it's very difficult to own your own space, and see people get kind of crammed into smaller and smaller places where you can't have guests and family to stay. So there is something, I can see it. I can see that it probably feels quite weird. I imagine when you try and explain this to your non-Christian friends and acquaintances over the school gate, you probably get some weird looks. Is this some kind of hippie free love commune? Are you wife swapping? All that jazz. But at the same time, I imagine there is also, as Des says, a kind of hunger for people who are like, I would love to just have a family meal with people and be accepted for who I am and be able to just share food and life together.
Yeah. I'd say it's 65 to 70% yearning, the reactions.
Really?
Yeah. And then people go, oh, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I could share my kitchen. but yeah, that appetite is very, very high.
The impact on the children. Again, I grew up in a home where a lot of a so-called open home. We had a lot of visitors, people passing through, and sometimes. And I think I can see it. It provided very positive role models for me, but also at times I felt constantly invaded, and I felt that I couldn't have enough of my parents because there were always strangers at every at every meal.
Yeah, we have to really keep an eye on it. We have our I think having a rule of life is so helpful because we're living with others. We are forced to be very intentional about a lot of these things, and so like the night that we are having just Oldfield family dinner is sacred, right? And the times when we are together as a four of us are built into our rule of life, and so the kids know that on Mondays the house will be full of people, and on open house days the house will be full of people. But on just also have house days that are just for us as the people that live here, and they're very protected, and we invest in time together. So that we have a sort of joke icon of Brené Brown up, because her her phrase that we say all the time is clarity is kindness. And I think that like the way community forces you into eternal negotiation and conversation, like what's working, what's not working, who's flourishing, who's not flourishing, how do we need to adapt this, it's actually hard to sustain as a so-called nuclear family.
Do you think the kind of turn to the nuclear family and or, you know, post-industrialization and the church's kind of pretty willing embrace of that, at least in our Western evangelical context, was a massive mistake and a kind of dead end? And would you, in your wildest dreams, hope that little communities like yours are the kind of beginning of where we start to dismantle some of that and the church becomes more fully believing in the sense that these are my brothers and sisters in Christ, and the fact that we may not share blood doesn't mean I have to, I can't live with them. And we kind of undo some of those last 200 years of retreating to the nuclear family.
Yeah, I think I do. I think what we see in the New Testament is a vision of the household that's not really about blood ties and inheritance in a way that for most cultures has been the key signifier of like who, what do I owe to who? And I don't think it's for everyone. And I'm also not rosy-tinted about it. Like, we did a huge amount of work before we moved into this. We spent a year meeting. We basically had a date night once a week for a year. We went on field trips. We read books. We prayed. We talked. And we moved in with the full awareness that it could get really difficult and it might end badly. And so I would love more Christians to be living in more open and interconnected ways. But, like, showing how you do it as grown-ups... showing that, and the reason that I'm so keen on the monastic tradition is the monastic tradition and the like hippie tune-in dropout communes are like photo negatives of each other, right? You, from the outside, you might think group of idealist people want to live together, but underpinning a lot of the utopian experiments is this very high anthropology that humans are basically good, and if we just like
got rid of rules,
we'd all figure it out. That's not what Christians think about humans. David Dahl has a book called Low Anthropology that I find immensely helpful. I find the doctrine of sin psychologically very astute. Like, we are beautiful and beloved and full of original glory and full of original sin. And monks have done the work, and nuns have done the work to go, how do you set up a household that takes that fact seriously and doesn't try and pretend it's not true? And that means you can have a very non-utopian, quite pragmatic way of living together with all our messiness that can be incredibly beautiful and meaningful. I feel more discipled in 4 years of living in community than the entire rest of my time in the church.
Although I take it you haven't got an abbot or an abbess.
Prior Elizabeth speaking.
Oh, absolutely not. Can you imagine? We have someone who we refer to as a kind of informal abbess, yeah.
Right.
We have someone who is in another community house and has long-standing experience who comes in and talks to us and is the kind of, like, arbiter if things are getting sticky and is wisdom. So, yes, there's lots of ways we don't map onto it, but we'd sort of like to map onto it more if we can.
And I guess the key evangelical critique of monasticism is that it's Christians creating a holy huddle out away from the world where they can just focus on contemplation and prayer and Bible study, but they're not actually getting stuck into the mission of God. And how do you feel you're going to tread that line about, you know, make sure this is not a way for you to kind of create a counterculture that ends up being so detached that Christians can no longer speak meaningfully into the rest of the society?
Yes. I mean, I think I'd want to defend mainstream monasticism from that. I think it shows a very low level of faith in the power of prayer, frankly. Like, having a bunch of people who it's their whole job to hold the pain of the world in the light of God seems good to me. But yes, what we are doing is hopefully a kind of liminal... Like, it's part of the reason we're in a city, and it's part of the reason we all still have jobs. We are very permeable. We are very outward facing and open. We're still involved in a local church. Our kids are in the local schools, right? We don't look that different in lots of ways. There's just more than a married couple trying to do life together. And I hope that means, like, I think our risk is the opposite, actually, that we're not distinctive enough. And I want to find the right line there.
And what about the intergenerational aspect? Because it strikes me that again, if you go back to the New Testament, that was very much more common to have, you know, all the generations living together. That seems much harder, doesn't it? I didn't tell you, Tim, that actually we're planning to move in, you know, just...
Pass.
So I'd actually like to hear, because you grew up in something not dissimilar to this, and maybe we can talk about this privately, but what were your experiences?
Well, I was going to say, for a long period as a teenager, my bedroom was the spare room, and so every few weeks, maybe once a month, I would be decamped to sleep back in my younger brother's bunk bed because my bedroom and my room had been given over to a guest, a friend, a waif and stray. Sometimes, you know, a core group of people who would kind of travel through London and were good friends of mum and dad. But often there would be people I've never met before who I never see again, who are through church circles or something, would need a place to stay in London. And I, with the benefit of a bit of hindsight and growing up a little bit, I have enormous kind of affection and admiration for what mum and dad did in using the kind of blessing of this, frankly, too big house in Zone 2, North London, and saying, we don't need all this space. You know, there were lodgers upstairs on a more kind of permanent arrangement, but also we can use it to, you know, host events and meetings and, but also more importantly, give hospitality and share food and a bed with people who either couldn't or don't want to pay for a hotel in London. I think that is an amazing gift, and I've tried in limited ways to kind of model some of that, you know, in my own home, much smaller house in Oxford. But it comes with costs, you know, and I experience some of the costs. It can be, like Dad was saying earlier, with your own experience as a kid, it can be a bit alienating to sense that, do my parents care more about these strangers than they care about me? Is this house ultimately my kind of safe space to retreat away from the world? Or is this perpetually open? You know, I mean, my wife's a vicar's daughter and she had a similar experience. You know, the vicarage is a public space and people were coming and going. And yet, if you're the vicar's kids, you just kind of live with the idea that people can knock on the door at any time. And there is, you know, it comes at a cost. And I guess the question is balancing that carefully and thinking there's huge gains to be had here to bless others with your hospitality and to be shaped by saying that we're not just a kind of close-knit nuclear family, but it has to be done carefully in a way that, and I think particularly, I've said before in the podcast, you know, I'm an adoptive dad and I'm increasingly keenly aware of the the fragility of the sense of home and security, and our daughter can find it difficult when we have guests and strangers in our house, because she has, you know, separation anxiety and other attachment issues. So yeah, it's we're probably not going to be able to be as hospitable as mum and dad were. Certainly not what you are, because we feel like we have a primary responsibility to help her feel secure in our lives. But then again, potentially, adoption is and also is an act of hospitality. She has no blood tie to me. I owed nothing to her until we felt the call from God to step in to be her new parents. And I think that models in a small way some of that New Testament ethic of the church, the family of God spreading beyond just those who share your DNA.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, let's draw a conversation to a close there. Thanks so much, Elizabeth. It's been a really interesting conversation, particularly hearing about the book and the way you're living in South London. If people want to find out a bit more about yourself, your writing, where they find the book, what would you point them to? Do you have a website?
I have a website, elizabethelford.com, and my Substack is morefullyalive.substack.com.
Brilliant. Do go and look at those. As always, there's lots of materials on Dad's website. That's johnwhite.com. And I also, who doesn't, have a Substack today. My Substack is tswyatt.substack.com, The Critical Friend. It's a weekly email newsletter about what's going on in the church. You can sign up to that for free. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got any thoughts about what we've been talking about today, disagreements, comments, contributions, you can email the podcast molad@premier.org.uk. That's MOLAD. And particularly if you've got suggestions of other people we should invite on, or other topics to discuss, we'd love to hear from listeners. Otherwise, we'll be back next week for another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.